Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for May 9th, 2019. Lots of topics to cover tonight. First of all, this craziness in Washington, D.C., pure theatrics, but this country is in desperate need of major, major work by our government, and it is not happening. So that's all I can say. I'm not going to go into this side or that side, or he said or she said, or whatever. This country is in great need of politicians who do work for this country and solve problems. This tit for tat, and you know, this would all go away if they took the cameras out of there. I've seen people on television say this is pure theatrics, and if you took the television cameras away, none of this would happen. These guys would be off drinking coffee. Anyway, I'm not going to go into any more of that. I don't want to discuss politics on this show. In fact, I'm pretty much going to ignore it until probably at least a year from now. Maybe I'll take a look at the news again. But Blue Origin space launch last week, and this is somewhat of a new policy I have, that even if something happens on the same day of my show, I'm going to wait to analyze it because all of the news does not come out right away. So last Thursday, the morning of my show, May 2nd, Blue Origin had a space launch that was successful. And in analyzing this afterwards, this was, I would say, very exciting news because this is a single stage rocket. This is back to like the Flash Gordon type of rocket. And basically, it's basically a joyride. It's not to go into orbit. So it's something like the Virgin Galactic space tourism type of venture in which you go up into outer space, you go for a space ride, you get some weightlessness, and then you come back down, and in this case, it will be with a parachute, where you parachute into the basically the desert. It lands in the desert, and I can only imagine from watching it, it's kind of a pretty good bounce when you hit the ground there. But the Russians have been doing this for decades, doing hard ground landings. The U.S. chose to land in the ocean, which is a bit more forgiving because the ocean is just water out there. The only issue with the ocean is if you have rough water or things like that, then you have complications. But on land, you can hit rocks. I mean, it just comes down there, baby, and you're coming down into the middle of the desert. If that thing hits a nice sharp rock, you know, sticking up, or you know, a hole, or maybe there's a little deformity in the land, you're going to hit that thing. But it comes down pretty hard. Hitting the water is almost like hitting cement when you come down at those speeds, even at parachute speeds. But at least you're not going to hit like a sharp rock or something. But anyway, people are starting to buy into this. People are putting their money down. People are trying to plan for their first, you know, beyond the you know, going to space type of deal. So I'll keep my feet personally on terra firma here for quite a while before I start going into outer space. And I would like to, maybe. But that brings up my next subject here, and is Earth unique? And the more we look out into space and look for other planets, the more we find that Earth is an extremely unique place. And I just want to throw this out there. Let's play the devil advocate. You know, at first, going back to the Middle Ages, it was stated that Earth was the only place that humans existed, and that they believed that the stars were, well, they didn't really know. They, you know, there was kind of a carryover from ancients where the firmament was just this dome, and the stars were just painted on the dome that revolved around Earth. But anyway, the Middle Ages didn't get much better. But it was still a Earth-centric, human-centric philosophy that was the guiding light of religions, etc. And it was the religions that actually maintained knowledge the books, the monks meticulously copying books that came books were a rarity until the Gutenberg printing press came along. But anyway, getting back to this topic, is Earth unique? Well, we look at our solar system here, and it turns out that Mars was an Earth-like planet not that long ago. And I'll be talking a little bit more about Mars because NASA comes out and says, oh, the dust storms destroyed all the water on Mars. Anyway, that's kind of like another bogus story. I'll be talking a little bit about that later. But back to the question, could it be that if, you know, all the billions of stars out there, etc., that Earth is really a very unique place? And here's the situation. If you take Earth and all of the properties that it has to support life as we see it on Earth, then it's probably pretty rare, because we look at the stars around us, the near stars, and they're finding planets, but they're big, they're kind of odd-shaped, they might have atmospheres with harsh chemicals in them, like Jupiter, but in other solar systems, other planets. You know, they probably don't have moons nor magnetic fields that shield them. Their star is not commensurate with, life support systems. Earth happens to spin on its axis every 24 hours. And that's a good thing because we get day and night, we get cooling and get warming. One side of the Earth doesn't get too hot, while the other side gets too cold. That 24 hours seems to be a real good balancing point. We have a moon which drives our magnetic field, which you won't read about in the astronomy textbooks. They say that, oh, the the magnetic field just rolls around and around in there, just those currents rolling around and around in the Earth causing that magnetic field. You know, it's absolutely ludicrous. The moon is what drives our magnetic field. And the moon, why does the moon do that? Because it's out in the solar wind. It's acting as a comet. It's charging, and it's literally driving. It's one of the driving forces of our geomagnetic field. Okay, so anyway, aside from the permanent magnets that's in the surface and the mantle of the Earth, the majority of Earth's magnetic field is from electrical currents. But electrical currents last for about 2.5 seconds if they don't have a driving force. So anyway, we have thousands of conditions on Earth that make it habitable. You know, liquid water, lots of liquid water. We have seawater, which is salty. We have fresh water, which is not salty, has very low mineral content. We have land available, which is above sea level, because it'd be pretty hard to have intelligent creatures develop in the water. The water has never been a good place for developing creatures that alter their environment. And that's where you separate kind of the intelligent species from the non-intelligent ones, like man. I would question whether you should call man an intelligent species. That's pretty questionable if you look at Congress. But as far as changing your environment to make it different than just walking around and bumping into trees and eating fruit that falls down on the ground. So anyway, but back to, is Earth unique? There probably might be somewhere out there Earth-like planets that might have some of the conditions of Earth, but not others. They might be, you know, a water planet, but no moon, no magnetic field. Or they might have thicker atmospheres with very different composition. So if you take the thousands of factors that go into making up the environment of planet Earth, and including the distance from the star, the conditions of the star itself, being in the right balance, not too hot, not too cool, you know, Earth is a pretty unique place. So for all those people that want to go out into outer space, you know, have at it. And I think that's a good, I'm all for it. I love my whole life as a physicist, mathematician, I've been in enchanted with the idea of outer space. But as far as going out there and finding another planet Earth to move to, it's not going to happen very soon. And it's not going to be like you're going to get on a space plane and go to this nice planet. Like I say, Mars was an Earth-like planet, and from all we can conjure through the little information that bleeds through from the hierarchy that keeps knowledge, real knowledge, away from the public, yes, Mars was habitable and recently, and it would have been a very much an Earth-like planet. Nuclear waste in the news. This is horrific. Let me just quick pull up this article. Where is it here? Okay. They're talking about 80 sites. This is out of mprnews.org. 80 sites. These are nuclear reactor sites where there's nuclear power being generated across the United States, where there is 80,000 metric tons of waste stored around the facilities, and they keep them in water tanks. The reason they keep them in water tanks is because they have to continue to cool them. And now I've been saying this, but I'm amazed this article actually says that. Here's the quote from the article. It says, by the way, just so I give it a proper reference, this is a April 30th, 2019 MPR, M as in Mary, mprnews.org. Anyway, they say they are under about 22 feet of water, these tanks containing the nuclear waste. And then they go on to say they are continuously being cooled as they still have some amount of decay heat even after they've operated in the reactor. And then they go on to say that they still have about the same amount of heat as was given off in the reactor to create electricity. And they still have that much heat in them. So what now they have to do is they have to continuously cool the water so that it, and so as this is a point of no return type of thing. So when the nuclear reactor burns fuel, okay, it's past useful lifetime, but still has a tremendous amount of heat contained in the nuclear fuel. They then put it in containers and drop it down into these water tanks where it then has to be cooled. Now, if that cooling process ever stops, which has happened because of flooding, for example, the spring flooding, that's one of the big scares, is that they're going to have to shut down one of these reactors for a week or two, and that these casks holding the nuclear spent fuel will begin to basically, with China syndrome, they're going to burn through there and they're going to, there's no way to contain them after that once they've destroyed the containment vessel. Anyway, this is an absolute massive disaster. Just a quick mention on measles. I was doing a little bit of research, and measles were eradicated in the United States in the year 2000. Now, what's going on, and this is why they're pushing for measles shots, is because people go outside the United States. There are, any given year outside the United States, there are 10 million cases of measles. And of these 10 million, about 100,000 of them die from measles. So it's a small percentage, but probably if you looked up how many people die from the flu every year, you would probably find a very similar percentage, maybe not exactly, that actually die from having the flu. But does the shot help? Once again, the problem, people from the United States who are not vaccinated go to other countries, and measles is very contagious. It's highly, highly contagious. If you're in the same room with somebody with measles, you're probably going to get it too. If you're in a bus station, if you're in a bus or an airplane or any place like that, you're probably going to get the measles if somebody has it there. There was a case just recently in Disneyland. Somebody that had measles went on one of the rides at Disneyland and gave it to a bunch of other people, and then they gave it to other people. It ended up to be about 300-400 people that ended up getting measles. So it almost makes you want to lock yourself at home. And in the Middle Ages, not to mention the Black Plague, but the reason Isaac Newton had the apple fall on his head, because he had a place to go to out in the countryside, and that's what a lot of the wealthy people did, is they went out to a country home and stayed there and just isolated themselves from the rest of the planet, basically, lived there during the time of the bubonic plague, the Black Plague. And that's when the apple fell on Newton's head and gave him the idea of gravity and acceleration and things like that. So but this issue of the worldwide population having measles, they were talking in this article about the level of vaccination around the world, and it might hit 30%. So, and apparently the measles vaccination does work. You get one when you're like, I don't know, young, 1 year old, and then you get another shot when you're like 4 years old or something. I don't know the exact time frame. Don't take that as a medical recommendation or anything else. But then if the issue with measles going on now, it's an issue going on in New York because somebody went to Israel, is the story that's being publicized. And in Israel, they don't have vaccinations. So when the measles start, it spreads like wildfire. And then somebody goes there, gets it, brings it back, and then mixes in with the population, in the synagogue or whatever. So anyway, the strange part about this is instead of quarantining the people that have it, they want to vaccinate all the people that never went to Israel, were not associated with these people. It's like having a little teeny tack in your hand, a little teeny nail, and taking a great big sledgehammer and slamming the nail, the little teeny nail, into the whatever you're driving the nail into. It's not a solution. Quarantining on a worldwide scale is not being done at all, and it would be done if the World Health Organization were doing its job. But apparently they're in collusion with Zurich and the other big medical companies. I believe it's Zurich is the only company that makes the measles vaccine. So the way to eradicate disease is to quarantine, not try and vaccinate the 7.5 billion people around the world who might get measles. And if you look at it, 10 million people out of 7.5 billion is a drop in the bucket. It's a very small number of people. And so what you do instead of vaccinating, because once you eliminate the measles virus, which is carried by people and delivered from people to other people, once you eliminate it, it's not going to be back. It's not going to be here anymore. Okay, changing subjects to become a bit more philosophical. This email came in from a listener, and so I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to also give my response. It said, "Hello, Professor. I texted this to a friend of mine. We were talking about conclusions of historians, and it goes on to say, I've always looked at how easy it is to peel a banana, and I thought, as you do, that our Creator built this creation a way to work and move in it. Why do horses have backs that can support the weight of a human? Why can we get along with them, for example?" Anyway, then he goes on, and this is the analogy, and the concept here is, what is God thinking, the Creator, about the people that don't recognize him? So anyway, here's the analogy. I'll read what the listener said. It says, "Imagine an artist overhearing a group of people who have just seen his painting. And they say, I believe that happened from some paint cans that fell off of the wall and spilled on the canvas. And he says, no, you're crazy. I painted that. Look at it. It's a masterpiece. and they act like they can't hear him, turn their backs, admiring the painting, yet continuing to parrot various theories all along the line of accidental paint spills, theorizing about where the paint cans were located and where the canvas was. At some point, the artist is going to be incensed and disgusted and want them to get away from his painting, even if they may admire the result, so others can come and enjoy it without hearing such stupid reasoning. So anyway, the listener makes some other points here, but I'm going to read my response basically on this. I respond saying, I love the example of the painter, so appropriate. We'll use this on my show next week. I cannot even imagine the wrath of the Creator towards all the people so intelligent with shiny degrees piled higher and deeper, PhDs, who deny God out of intellectual diversions. The universities are full of them with no room for anyone else who disagrees, putting themselves above, and how absurd. Just the idea that they have to learn and have no knowledge of their origins, yet they refuse to understand that we are just scratching the surface of even understanding a fraction of the organization of the universe. They were not aware at their births and certainly do not know anyone who was around when their evolution god was allegedly doing his thing. You know, religion has done more to separate people from their spirits than anything. Imagine repeating over and over again. Oops, I lost my place here. Just a second. Imagine repeating over and over again the mantras of prayer to make you holy, filling all that time with repetition, while the entire time the people are completely unaware of their internal spirit occupying their physical bodies. I was thinking the other day about this. Do people who we consider the walking dead really have a soul, as they certainly do not appear to have one? I came to two conclusions. One I already had realized long ago. That is, number one, when atheists die, their souls simply go away into nothingness, as they spent their entire existence wasting it on self-admiration and denial of the Creator. I imagine there's some justice there. You deny the entity that created you, and at the end, the judgment is a simple yes. You do not exist anymore, since the people who took the time and their brain to simply acknowledge God and his infinite design are doing the one simple thing that they were created for, and that is to admire and simply say thank you and to be a friend of the Creator who would be alone without them. How simple. The second point is that I believe that all the walking dead do have souls, but they simply are completely unaware of them, so in fact act as animals, dogs, cats, simply responding to external stimuli. They die never having a clue as to whom they are, know why they were given this amazing opportunity of life. So anyway, that's my response. And it's really amazing. And I know people who are devout, religious, go to church, and are completely unaware, unattached to the spirit that's living in their bodies. And it's something that when I spent a lot of time going out into the wilderness, which I did as a young person, I still try to do that as much as possible. But you have to spend long periods of time by yourself to start to communicate with your inner spirit. And if you don't think you have one, you know, the human is very much different than a dog or a cat. Dog or a cat or a monkey or, you know, whatever. Remember that Carl Sagan in Modern Science tells you that you're just a monkey. You're just like the, you know, you're just a little smarter monkey than the one still out there hanging out in the jungle. That's what they tell you. Nobody talks about the spirit. You never hear Carl Sagan saying, gee, I've had some good communication with my spirit today, and I'm very much in touch, my body and my spirit that's contained in my body, that we are directing my body what to do based on, you know, it's anyway, it is, these people are so out of touch. They think that the body is, that's it. There's just a body here. And you're, like I say, you're just a little smarter monkey than the one out there in the jungle. Anyway, I hope you, if you're not in communication with your internal spirit, take some time, go into the bathroom by yourself, go into the closet by yourself, go off in the woods, better yet, go someplace by yourself. And just sit there and say, wow, you know, I really have spent most of my life going around, driving cars, using credit cards, going shopping, looking at ads on TV. And if you look at all the diversions in life today, that's what they are. They're diversions. And nobody, you don't listen to the evening news and they don't start out by saying, hey, have you had a good, you know, communication with your internal spirit lately? You ain't going to hear that on the evening news. You're not going to hear that on, you know, any other radio program that I know of. Nobody's going to talk about this. And this is a scientific issue, that you have a being living inside your body and it is doing a lot of, you know, the control of your body. A dog or a cat runs around, they smell food, well, they go over and eat it. You know, they, you know, run down the street and, you know, whatever is going on, they see a bird, they, you know, a cat sees a bird, it has to go hunt it. People are not like that. And the reason is, you're not just another smarter than average monkey. You have a spirit inside you, which, you know, is growing up with you and is part of your being. It's the two. And when your body dies, the spirit leaves. Okay, I'm going to revert back to this topic. A few weeks ago, remember the black hole, the picture of the black hole that everybody was talking about? And luckily, that has left the news. But it was really a non-story because literally you can't take a picture of a black hole. So what they took a picture of was material surrounding something that they thought was a black hole. Anyway, back in 1978, Perseus and Wilson won a Nobel Prize. And the reason was there was a big political contest in the scientific world. Not that science is political, which it totally is. But there was a back and forth between Hoyle, Fred Hoyle, and a whole group of people that believed in the Big Bang. And this goes all the way back to Edwin Hubble, who first noticed the redshifts of objects in outer space, galaxies, and then eventually quasars were discovered as a result of basically radio technology that came out of World War II. And then they started looking at these things and they said, well, these are really, you know, kind of big star-like things out there. But anyway, the quasars had high redshifts, very high redshifts. And so as part of the Big Bang philosophy, then they were determined to be the farthest objects because if they had the biggest redshifts, that meant they were moving the fastest since the alleged Big Bang. And so on and on and on. And so out of this comes a tremendous amount of nonsensical physics. Physics that had to basically be created to account for these anomalies. But back in the 1970s, there were two camps. There was the steady state camp trying to figure out where all this material came from. And then there was the Big Bang camp. And at that point, they started noticing the microwave background radiation in all directions around Earth. And of course, this is long before they could send up a satellite and do decent measurements. But that was kind of the crowning experimental achievement that tipped the scales in favor of Perseus and Wilson and the Big Bang. So ever since the Nobel Prizes have every now and then cycled into Big Bang type of things. And one of them was given for the COBE satellite NASA effort, which is totally in contrary to the Nobel Prize rules, which it cannot be a government agency, cannot be a company. It has to be individuals working for the furtherance of science. But science has become totally government-dominated, so it's hard to extract individuals anymore unless I'm about the only person that I know on the planet that is a scientist that works independently and does not get money under the table or whatever. But anyway, 1978, Nobel Prize for Physics to the Big Bang champions based on the idea that there was a microwave background radiation. And that's what the COBE satellite Nobel Prize was based on. And they picked a few people out of the team, although there were many people on the team. What I'm seeing now is with this picture of the black hole with teams of scientists, all of them government supported, all of them using government equipment, interpreting the information coming from government supported equipment to support the Big Bang, their pet theory, trying to drive more and more nails into the coffin of any other concepts. In spite of the fact that the Big Bang, let's look at the two major contributing pieces of data that prop up the Big Bang, in addition to general relativistic concepts like black holes, etc. But number one is the microwave background radiation. All they're looking at is the cloud of dust and material that's held back by solar wind pressure that surrounds our solar system. That is what's causing the microwave background radiation in all directions. And that's what they first noticed pre-1978. And that's what they're still saying. Until you get a space probe outside of that with microwave detectors and you start looking around and you go, hey, there's no microwave background radiation if you get outside of this localized dust cloud. Secondly, it's the redshift. And this goes back to Edwin Hubble, early 1900s. He's the first guy to have good telescopes with spectroscopic equipment. He was the first one to see galaxies and take their spectrums and understand that everything is redshifted. No matter which direction you look, everything is redshifted. And so then he immediately started this idea of the Big Bang. Then we have the Eddington experiment, which was cherry-picking data. Terrible, terrible experimental, what would you call it? Fraud. Pure fraud. And even Einstein was totally against the data being used to corroborate general relativity, which Einstein disagreed with himself. But it was railroaded into prominence. And so anyway, now it appears that they're trying to railroad more of this data. So that's my prediction, is that somehow the Nobel Committee will be conned into giving some kind of related Nobel Prize to this picture of the black hole deal, which once again is general relativity being a cornerstone of modern cosmology. It has to be mixed in with the other elements of Big Bangism to create an entire picture. But once again, all of this can be explained because the redshifts are not due to movement of stars or galaxies or quasars. It's due to the internal property. The induced electric dipole redshift is the cause of the redshifts. It's due to a non-uniform electric field around the quasars, etc. And there's so much data. Bainbridge, Haltenarp, other people have shown great quantities of data showing that the quasars are literally connected physically by electrical connections or by observable connections, is what they actually have seen, by taking pictures in all different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum, and you still see that electrical connection. And I'm the one that's putting electrical in there. These are discharges between the quasar and the associated galaxy. And so it's just like a comet nucleus. There is so much data that disproves the Big Bang, one of them being that comets exhibit redshifts. As you go in closer to the comet nucleus, you will see more and more redshifted data. So there's no black hole there. There's no massive object. it's not moving away from us at the speed of light. So anyway, that there's so much data that contradicts what they're doing, it's not funny. But that's my prediction, is that they're fishing. They have a fishing contest on. It's a bass fishing contest for a Nobel Prize. Once again, this has popped up, the idea that renewables cannot drive our economy, will never be sufficient. And this guy Schellinger is running around getting press. And then, of course, he's a nuclear energy front man, whether he likes it or not. And I always have the question when I see these jokers. So where do they get who's buttering their bread? Where do they get their money from? How come these people can run around, have web pages with no visible means of support? Somebody's given him money, just like the ding-dong Phil Plate, the jerk astronomer that's never worked as an astronomer other than taught a couple years in a community college, which is not a big deal, believe me. He's never had a job as an astronomer, runs a blog page. Where do these people get their income? Well, clearly somebody's sliding them some money under the table to keep them going. Okay, so anyway, renewables as we know them, three-blade wind turbines and solar, will never solve the world energy problem. And I found it interesting, there's an article that was sent in by a listener from RT, Russian television news. And they're talking about the flatlining of renewables in the year 2019. In other words, it did not grow. It didn't grow from the previous year, and it's the first time since the year 2000 when renewables actually took foothold and began to sell. It's the first time that renewables did not outmatch the sales of the prior year. But what's going on here is that the subsidies are dropping off. The government subsidies that have kept these businesses lucrative are dropping off, and their whole business model is based on government subsidies. That's where their profit comes from. In fact, it's more than profit. They would have a hard time selling, even breaking even, without government subsidies. So that's interesting, in that people are finally waking up that this is a scam. But as I said in my book, The McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, said this a long time ago, even before the book was published, that this whole thing was a design scam. General Electric and Siemens put out products that would never compete against their core business. And when they got done sucking all of the money out of government subsidies, government investment, private investment, and putting these ridiculous solar panels that cover thousands of acres and wind generators that cover thousands of acres, and they sit there not working, then they will go away and have some joker like this Schellinger guy come in and say, oh, we got to go back to nuclear, which is GE and Siemens core business. Isn't that special? So just a quick mention. Last week I talked about Elon Musk having a little explosion during a test of the escape system for his Dragon crew capsule. And this week, the Martin Marietta Orion mission is marching forward, trying to gain traction and just basically trying to muscle everybody else out of the way. Interestingly enough, the Boeing Starliner uncrewed vehicle had an engine abort during a test, and they had a setback. So Boeing's not doing real well. It looks like what NASA really is pushing for is NASA has contracted with Martin Marietta to do the Orion mission. And so that's where they want to put all their eggs. NASA is working glove in hand with Martin Marietta. It's very clear. And so, but I'll tell you, I'll repeat it. My opinion is that probably NASA, Martin Marietta, and Boeing all had a little finger in the explosion of the Musk space capsule. And the release of the information, the way it was released, basically illegally against contract to the public. Now, here's a story. Remember, I told you I'd be talking more about space and private space programs, and so I'll be attempting to do that. Here's a story. Here's an outfit. It's called Spin Launch, and I've had little run-ins with this outfit before. I'm not going to say where or why or how, but basically, this is an outfit that says they're going to launch from the surface of the Earth payloads into outer space, and they're going to fling them at supersonic speed out of a tunnel. Basically, it's like an acceleration tunnel. It's like a, let's put it this way. It would be like a magnetic railgun in the form of a spiral, and the satellite then gets accelerated and then comes out the end at supersonic speed. It does not have a rocket. In other words, they're going to give it an initial velocity, and then it's going to go up through the atmosphere, and then they have another secondary rocket, they say now, which this is, by the way, a new addition to the twist on this story, this additional rocket that will take it into low Earth orbit. But the problem here is when this thing comes out of this magnetic acceleration gun, we'll call it, first of all, the acceleration is going to be absolutely incredible. And I'm familiar with electronics. I'm familiar with the radiation-hardened electronics and military-grade electronics. There's nothing built by man that's going to withstand the acceleration of this thing coming around this tube and then hitting the atmosphere at like multiple Mach speed, and then having to travel through miles, you know, 10 or 15 miles of thick atmosphere at this speed without, the concept, if you look at traditional launches, they keep the velocity down to well below Mach 1. Below the speed of sound, until they get up really, really high. Then they can break the sound barrier and go supersonic. But the problem with the spin launch thing is that, just looking at basic physics and what this thing is going to have to do, what kind of payload can you launch? The only thing I could even imagine that might withstand the G-forces and the pressure and the dynamic pressure that this thing is going to experience might be a bowling ball. I mean, that's the most. And they got $40 million in funding, and it was like from Google and some other places. But it's like I've always said, the things that won't work get funded. And it's just the oddest thing to see. I had an investor talk to me. In fact, two investors in the last couple of months talked to me. And these were venture capital groups, which I don't deal with at all. I don't have anything to do with venture capital people. I think they're idiots. I think they are thieves. I think they have... I've just had bad experiences in my life, and their whole philosophy of loaning and starting companies is that they destroy more companies than they help. But anyway, the conversation, which I've heard before, they say, well, we only have a very small percentage of success rate. Only 10% of the companies we invest in succeed. Therefore, we have to really dig into those companies to make our money back. And my comment is, well, wait, my company is successful. It's already successful. Why should I pay you for all your bad investments? You know, that's what I told them. It's like, I'm not going to pay you big amounts of money because you have 9 out of 10 failures. And then I said, I look at the stuff that people invest in, and it's ridiculous. It's stuff that couldn't possibly work. And here's another case of that. And I could go down a laundry list of other things I've seen, not the least of which are in the energy sector, these big float things they take out in the ocean in the North Sea and to bob up and down and create electricity. The cost and payback costs, and they'll never happen. There's been an analysis done on the three-blade wind turbines and the amount of steel and manufacture that goes into these things. The payback on those, just to pay back the materials, is 39 years. Without government subsidies, you can never build a business model based on these ridiculous technologies. But they get funding, and they get government, the people in government, to buy into this. So anyway, and I also told them that the average company that gets good investment, it's like a show. It's like a show and tell. Look at all these people we have on our board of directors. Look at all these people we have working here, scientists, etc. And they have projects that are stupid. They don't make any sense at all. I just saw one. Here's one. I'm kind of getting off on a tangent here, but this is worth talking about. I just saw one where a company is investing in, get this, they believe that they can power the world by taking body heat from human beings and converting it into electricity. That is like, now let's just look at this from a reasonable point of view. There's 7.5 billion people in the world. And if they do this in buildings where they're talking about air conditioning, etc. Every person gives off about the amount of heat as a 100-watt light bulb. That's quite a bit. And so if they have 1,000 people in a ballroom, they need to provide air conditioning that will cool down the air to keep it at nominal 72 degrees or whatever, 23 degrees Celsius, so that the people are comfortable. But here's a company that says it's going to trap excess heat coming off of people and convert it into energy, and that's going to solve the world energy problem. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You can't even be serious. Where do the people, they must be smoking some really good medical marijuana or something. I mean, this doesn't make any sense at all. How would you trap in the, a thermal process is very inefficient. It's a Carnot cycle. And then you'd have to have some kind of thing around people, and then you'd have to transmit that energy to the grid. I mean, what are people thinking? And these people are getting funding for this. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, it just astounds me. Here's a note from the International Space Station. It is contaminated with unknown viruses, and you have people, astronauts, scientists, whatever, going up to the International Space Station and coming back. They don't know how to clean it. They don't, it's infected with viruses, and they don't even know what the viruses are. Now, space is laden with viruses. It's where a lot of viruses form. It's not unusual to have the nucleotides and bigger constructs of DNA forming in outer space. And what is a virus? It's simply an unidentified, basically cell, like a living cell, but on an extremely primitive level. And it's something that is foreign to the human body. So when you get a virus, what happens, the external conditions are that your body is reacting to it, and that's why you get sweat, or you have upset stomach, or you throw up, or your nose runs, or you, all of the different conditions, high fever. It's your body attempting to get rid of this thing. But yeah, the International Space Station, a nice growing experiment for unknown viruses. Very interesting. Japan just launched its first private rocket this week. And so they're, private companies entering the space race. Once again, rockets are not the way to go into space. There's a new Mars rover on the block. And one of the old ones bit the dust due to a dust storm, literally. So the two Mars rovers, I believe both of them have completely succumbed and are no longer operational on Mars. Now, here's a story that is a lead-in from what I was just talking about, the dust storms on Mars. And NASA is now stating that dust storms are what caused in the past, billions of years ago, they say, that this caused the water to leave Mars. Well, right now, if you had water on Mars, the atmospheric pressure is not strong enough to hold water there in the first place. So, but the surface of Mars is covered with geological evidence of water. It's just everywhere. And what they're telling you even in the news is very limited. I was in a meeting, an American Geophysical Union meeting a number of years ago, and I went into a room because it was going to be a talk on the newest, latest pictures from Mars, surface pictures. And I went in there, and the two gentlemen that were going to give the talk, they were geologists working for NASA. There was nobody in there. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing, because to me, this would be one of the top talks that everybody would, I would think, would want to go to look at all of the latest photos on Mars. And so anyway, we sat down and we were talking there, and they knew who I was. And I, you know, they were showing me some of the pictures, the photographs, and they said there's erosion on Mars everywhere, not only in the dirt, in the sediment, but in the rocks. And they had spillways coming across rocks, and they were geologists that were familiar with Earth geology, and they said this is all recent stuff. That their conclusion was that Mars had significant amounts of water recently. But whenever you look at the publications or the gee-whiz stuff that comes out of NASA press releases, it's always billions of years ago. And I've stated this, I have a very good section of photos on my Picture of the Day subpage dealing with the surface features of Mars and the water surface features of Mars. But the dust storms are the key to understanding that all of this was recent. Not millions of years ago, not even hundreds of thousands of years ago, certainly not billions of years ago, but recent, like at most a couple thousand years ago. And what happened very clearly is that Venus the comet came by and alleviated Mars of its water and atmosphere. And right now, like I say, if you put water on Mars, if you could somehow populate the surface of Mars to the level it was in history, in recent history, it would not last very long at all, because Mars simply has a very faint atmosphere, and the water would evaporate, and it might freeze during a winter, but then it would evaporate as soon as Mars turned around and the sun hit it. It would evaporate, and it would go off into outer space very quickly. So the current atmospheric conditions of Mars would not hold water even if it were there. The only place you might find it is near the poles, where it would be frozen. But other than that, and that's where it's going to stay if it is there. NASA thinks that there might be some there. But frankly, I don't know. I'd have to see. But the point is that for the majority of the planet Mars, water is not going to stay there, even if you brought it back in mass quantities. So it's an issue that you can see the pristine riverbeds, you can see the erosion, you can see all of the surface features of Mars. You can see, which I pointed out before, that the cratering on Mars is only in the highlands. And so the lowlands where the water was, the oceans, the craters would not form. Or even if they formed, they would not be very long-lasting. And so you have Mars with heavy cratering wherever there is high ground and no cratering at all where there is low ground. Once again, indicating that there was water recently. at least the bombardment or the selective cratering of Mars occurs. It's only visible in the highlands because where there were oceans, the craters never formed. The idea that, and here's another interesting thing that came out of these news releases, is that Los Alamos has a laser experiment on one of the rovers, and what they did is they started examining rocks, noticing that water-soluble chemicals in the soil were dispersed, which meant that there had been liquid water and it was in the side of a crater. But anyway, the point is that when the young scientist was giving his dissertation on this, he stated that they can tell sequences of events, in other words, when it was dry or wet, etc., in sequence, but they could not tell timing. They could not put a date on anything. Yet NASA continues to put dates on the timing when water was present on Mars without any data. In other words, they're just making statements. And once again, basically lying to the public. And this gets down to some really major issues, because it's very clear that, number one, Mars had oceans and a much different atmosphere, a much larger atmosphere recently, because the geological conditions state that. Also, we know from the historical record that people talked about Mars as being a blue planet. We also know that the ancients talked about Mars losing its atmosphere and oceans at a single event when a large comet came by, and that is the comet that's heart eventually became the planet Venus. And we know that Mars came very close to Earth and would have been accessible for space travel from ancient advanced civilizations. So in lying about the water on Mars and keeping this facade like they're going to go back and discover where the water is, or coming up with these felonious stories about the dust causing the water on Mars to disappear, but billions of years ago, is an effort to silence the true history of the human race. This is disgusting, it's deplorable, it's despicable, and once again, NASA is never a straight answer. At any rate, I'm about out of time here. I just want to quick mention that the MR7 water filters are on sale at 15% off from the sale price. So this is going to last for a short time. So you can get complete filtration for your entire house and greatly reduce prices when you buy a filter pack, the replacement filter pack, with the original unit. The other water filters and filter elements are on sale. The only place you can find all-in-one filters that you do not need add-on filters, and then, of course, my books and DVDs, CDs, the calendar, etc. on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.